A very warm welcome to This Is Money Show on Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost, and in the studio with me is editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss to round up the week's top stories they've been covering on their award-winning website. And it seems politicians have been listening to last week's episode. The general election argued Simon should not all be about Brexit. And over the week, we've got a number of U-turns, plans and promises on money matters, from probate fees, the triple lock and energy price caps.
The last time I think a Conservative government was so aggressive in its overt price caps for utility bills was back in Ted Heath's era.
I give you that commitment now. Labour will maintain the triple lock.
Well, can anyone fix the housing crisis? Jeremy Corbyn thinks his party can. Not everyone's so sure.
Whether it's Labour or Conservative, for the last 30 years, all we've heard, particularly in election campaigns, is how they're going to be the party of housing.
We didn't have great news for the UK economy this week. Growth now at its weakest since the EU referendum. But is GDP really the best measure?
The perfect GDP man would be obese, would be driving a car to work every time, gets stuck in traffic, probably have a serious chronic disease.
And with all the excitement about the general election here and Brexit, could Frexit be on the cards? We keep an eye on events on the other side of the channel. And the clock is ticking on the old paper fiver.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
And welcome to This Is Money Show. In the studio, editor Simon Lambert, personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. A very good morning. Warm welcome to you both. Now, after Simon refusing to be distracted by Brexit, set out the money questions we need to ask those MPs vying for our votes, a week on, has anyone been listening? Well, yes. In amongst the benign herbivores and a mutton-headed old mugwump mature name-calling, we did actually get a wealth of non-EU-related chat. Jeremy Corbyn reckons he's the man to fix the housing crisis. There was a lot about the triple lock protection for pensions. Will it stay? Will it go? Will it become the double lock, as perhaps Theresa May suggested? And we got news of an energy price cap from the Tories. Now, this was all manifesto policy stuff that may come in. One that won't is a rise in probate fees to as much as £20,000. So Simon, Rachel, let's head here first. I know both of you have written a fair bit about this. Rachel, just remind us if you would, what was the plan here? Why was this so contentious? What would the U-turn on probate fees?
So probate fees are what families have to pay when someone passes away to sort of gain access to their estate and sort things out. At the moment, it's a flat fee, £215, which arguably sort of just about covers the cost of all that admin. The plan was to make probate fees dependent on the size of the estate. And so while some people might end up not paying any at all, some people could pay up to £20,000, which is a fairly steep rise from 215. It was contentious because so many different reasons. One, just the incredible leap. Two, arguably, what is still called a fee, you could really say is a tax on probate when it's not covering the cost but actually making money. And thirdly, how are people going to pay it? So you have to come up with this fee before you have access to the estate. So some people might end up suddenly with a bill for 20 grand with no money to pay for it. So what do? Do they take out a loan? Do they borrow it from someone else? It's pretty difficult at a time when things are already pretty difficult. It was contentious as well because the government ran a consultation on it and they asked people what they thought, and almost everyone said, we think this is a really bad idea, but didn't matter. They just went ahead and did it anyway.
Yeah, let's not make any bones about this. They didn't scrap it because no one wanted it. They scrapped it because the Ministry of Justice said they couldn't implement it in time.
Well, that's right. There are all sorts of things that were on the cards that now we've got this snap election are being ditched either completely or temporarily. Time will tell.
Simon, is this inevitable anyway once they do have time to implement this?
I'm not so sure, to be honest, on this one. I'd watch out for something else being sneaked through. But I think that this was just a really bad idea from our point of view and from the point of view of 98% of the people who replied to the consultation and said it was a bad idea, but not from the point of view of the government and Ministry of Justice, who I think, to be honest, were probably surprised by the backlash against this and the headlines that it drew. I think that they just reckoned they were going to manage to sneak this one through. Because you don't pay these fees until you have to process someone's estate. And I think the other way they thought they could sneak it through is because it sounds like probate fees, sounds like that's for the cost of probate, okay? Mm. But as someone who has had the misfortune of doing probate twice recently, for my dad and for my nana, helping my mum do that, basically you do all the work as the executor. You gather together all the information, you have to write to all the banks, you have to get back all of the financial details, then you have to fill out some very long forms, then you have to fill out another form for the probate fee. You can get a solicitor to do this for you, but they will probably charge you quite a lot of money, probably a few thousand pounds. Now, at the end of all of that, you have to send these forms off, and there is essentially a rubber stamping exercise. So what you should think of is this is not akin to processing someone's estate. This is akin to what happens when you pay for your passport application or your driving licence renewal. So actually, to raise that from £215 to as much as £20,000, and let's face it, most people weren't going to be paying that £20,000, but there'd be an awful lot of people in the middle ground who were now paying a grand or two. Yeah. And I had this discussion with the Ministry of Justice, and I said, well, how do you justify this? Having paid this £215 flat fee, I thought £215 was a bit steep, to be honest, but maybe okay, you don't really factor in all of the other costs to do with, you know, running a building, paying people's wages and things like that. And they openly said they were going to use this to subsidise the rest of the court system. They admitted that they didn't know how much it cost to actually process a probate application, but they did admit this was going to subsidise the rest of the court system, and they said that they thought that was absolutely fine. And I personally believe that that's not, and a lot of people happen to agree with that view. And I think that the thing that was really bad about this is that in the budget document, it essentially admitted that what they had done is taken a fee and turned it into a tax. Mm-hmm. And there was some debate as to whether they were actually allowed to do that, even if they had have put it through in this finance bill, as to whether the finance bill was allowed to cover that. So I'm not surprised that they ditched it. It's been a convenient excuse. I would think that they'll probably try and bring it back in some kind of way, though. So keep a keen eye on it.
Rachel, what's the finance bill?
So this was a bill that passed just now, and it was, I don't know, a few hundred pages long. It had all sorts of stuff in, from the budget. When the Chancellor stands up and says all the things that he wants to do, it's not just that that's, you know, waved through straight away. It's got to go through Parliament. And when this snap election was announced, the government basically had to pick its battles. It couldn't get the whole thing through. There were too many things that were contentious. And also, it's not a very good system to sort of get things done quickly instead of having proper debate and discussion that's required. So they picked their battles, bunch of stuff just totally ditched that we were all a couple of days ago scrambling through trying to work out what had stayed and what had gone and what the impact of that would be.
All right. Well, Simon, I just wanted to talk to you because a lot of the policies and plans that you spoke about last week, if you remember, we discussed it and you asked, you know, what have the Tories done for us when we need to ask our MPs about these money questions? And a lot of them seemed, well, rather unusual for the Tory government. They hit a lot of perhaps their traditional voters. I'm talking things like the tax squeeze on the self-employed, a cut to pensions, annual lifetime allowances. We've got another rather unusual one this week from the Conservatives, and this is plans for an energy price cap.
The last time I think a Conservative government was so aggressive in its overt price caps for utility bills was back in Ted Heath's era. Certainly previously what they used were much more regulation per se, things like RPI minus X measures, which basically mean you have to adjust your prices less than inflation. But personally, I'm surprised because it actually seems to me as if, and I've done it myself recently, the mechanisms you can use via these various switching companies seem pretty well established. I guess the fear is underneath all of this, you can move from one to the other. There's just not effective competition. There's a bit of an oligopoly. There's five or six key players. You can move between them, but there's a bit of an old boys network. And the trouble is, of course, utilities, it's hard to be very innovative with it. I mean, with a bank, you can have challenger banks or perhaps use technology. And there's a little bit of that in utilities, but not so much.
All right, Simon. Firstly, a energy price cap from the Tories.
Yes, I was working on Sunday and I came home and my wife said to me, she said, so did anything happen today in the news? I said, no, not much. The Tories are probably going to raise taxes and they're going to cap energy prices. And Ed Miliband's looking at this and scratching his head. and thinking, hang on a minute, that was my plan that I got lambasted for. That was why everybody said don't vote for Miliband, because he's going to raise taxes and he's got this crazy energy price cap idea. So, yes, it
careful
is...
Careful with what you just said there, yeah, Simon.
Yeah, exactly.
It is what do you really think of the
idea?
It
is a slightly unusual scenario. I think that what they're getting at here, this is slightly different to Ed's freeze. And as far as I'm aware, they haven't written it on a giant headstone. So, you know, wait for that. The thing is what they are trying to look at here...
I'd forgotten about that, Simon.
The headstone. Had you forgotten about the headstone? I think,
where is it
I
now? Think, oh, with the same place as the Michael Jackson statue.
No, I think I read a story. Didn't they demolish it or something? So there was some talk of them selling it off, and I think that they decided that it should be forgotten about forever and ever and ever. I don't think anyone's going to let them forget about that forever and ever and ever.
Thank you for reminding me, Simon.
Mind you, I'd love to see what John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn could come up with given a giant piece of stone. I think that what the Tories are trying to do here to get back onto the energy price cap is this is aimed at all the people who just do not switch their energy bills. These are the people who are really having the screw put on them by the system. These are the people who are overpaying for their energy bills. We know that however much you say to people, switch your energy bills. It's really easy. Look, go here. You could find out if you could save £300 or £400 a year. Seriously, switch your energy bills. It's really easy. Look at that money you're giving up. There is a percentage of people who just are not interested and just will not do it.
A huge percentage of people.
There is also a percentage of people who are a bit excluded from that scenario because they might not be so internet savvy. It tends to skew towards people on lower incomes. And so what they are trying to do is help those people by capping those standard variable tariffs and trying to make sure that whilst the people switching around all the time are saving money and doing very well, that the other people aren't essentially paying the price for that.
But isn't there an argument, Rachel, if you have a price cap that some people would suggest, oh, it's all right, the government have got this in hand, I don't need to switch around. So we could become more lazy.
Well, we're so lazy, a little bit more lazy, I don't really know what the difference would be. Something like 6 million switched in 2015. The numbers aren't going up. And switchers tend to stay switchers, and non-switchers will be on the most crusty old tariffs that are costing them. I don't even want to think about how much, probably with British Gas. So I don't know that necessarily should be the major concern. I mean, we've been worrying about this for so many years now, and we've had review after review, most recently the Competition Markets Authority, and they suggested all sorts of things. A lot of them I thought were completely bonkers. But we haven't really considered those yet. Instead, we're just going in. Well, sorry, the Conservative Party is suggesting that we go in with a sledgehammer and then hit prices, all of them, across the board on the head and hope that that makes a difference.
So is that, in sum, a thumbs up or a thumbs down?
I'm glad that they're taking action, and perhaps it will narrow the difference between what people like me are paying, who are being subsidised by those who are paying too much. I don't know. Jury's still out on this side. I don't know if a cap is the answer.
All right, fair enough. Well, we've talked about energy price caps. We've talked about probate fees. We are running through money manifesto plans, and I haven't known pensions to be such a hot topic since the freedoms were brought in. So will it be saved, scrapped, turned into a less generous double lock? I'm talking about the triple lock protection for pensions. Here's what we've heard so far from the two main party leaders.
Will the Prime Minister give a clear and unambiguous commitment to maintaining the triple lock on the state pension?
Yes.
Prime Minister!
I've been very clear that under this Conservative government, we have seen pensioners benefit as a result of what we've done to the basic state pension. The tune of £1,250 a year. And I am clear that under a Conservative government, pension and incomes would continue to increase.
Theresa May seems incapable of answering any question about the protection of the triple lock on the state pension. Well, I give you that commitment now. Labour will maintain the triple lock.
So, Simon, you've been looking at the debate surrounding the triple lock protection for pensions. What's going on here? What is the triple lock, first of all?
What it is a guarantee that the state pension will rise by the greater of three numbers. That is either inflation, the rise in average wages, or 2.5%. Now, the tricky component of this equation is 2.5%. And that says an awful lot about the world that we live in now, about the low inflation, low wage, low growth, which is all linked to those, which is linked to those two things, world, that basically the 2.5% number is giving us the big problem. And let's face it, 2.5% is a pretty measly number. Yet, this has become a serious hot topic. It was brought in by the coalition government. It was announced in 2010. And the idea was that basically it was to try and deal with those scenarios where, do you remember stories about pensioners getting a 75p rise and stuff like that? It was to try and deal with that scenario, because what was happening was that their pensions were going up with inflation. Now, the way that economists like to measure pensions is as replacement income. So basically, how much of the average wage would the state pension replace? Now, because they were linked to inflation and wages had been rising at a rate that was higher than inflation, remember those crazy days of real pay rises? Pensioners were falling behind in the income stakes. And also there is this argument that obviously the inflation number that we get doesn't really reflect inflation for everyone, because everyone's inflation rate is different. Mm-hmm. And actually that the inflation rate for older people is considerably higher, because they have to spend more money on the kind of essentials that go up by more than the average inflation rate. And so this was brought in to try and do something about it. And to be perfectly honest, it has worked. It's worked really well. There's a Institute for Financial Studies report earlier this year calculated that between April 2010 and April 2016, the value of the state pension increased by 22.2% compared to a 7.6% rise in earnings growth and a 12.3% rise in consumer prices. Our pensions are by no means massively generous on an international scale, as we talked about a few weeks ago. However, on the measure of that replacement ratio, they are now at the highest share of average earnings since April 1988. What this has led to, of course, is lots of studies saying about how pensioners are now doing better than everybody else. We don't have enough money to pay for all the things we're meant to do. This is an expensive promise. It's raised the cost of the pensions bill by an estimated £6 billion a year since it was brought in. And to put that into context, the OBR put state spending in 2016 at £89.4 billion. So basically it's added about an extra 7% on there. It accounts for 7% of that. So the question is, what do we do about this? Do we keep it? Do we ditch it? The Tories have promised to keep it until 2020. However, it's expensive. There was kind of talk that they should maybe get rid of it. It's a bribe for older people and everything. The chance of a new election gives them the chance to do that. But Jeremy Corbyn has leapt in and said, hold on a minute, I'm going to keep it.
But so, only until 2025, isn't that right? Or is he going to keep it forever? I thought it was 2025.
Well, I don't
either
know.
Way,
yeah. The longer you keep it, the longer it starts to become enshrined and the harder it is to get rid of it. So if we'd have got rid of this at the last general election, maybe there would have been less of a fuss. Then we were going to keep it to 2020. Now, probably if we get rid of it now, it will have only been around for like 6 or 7 years. So we could probably get away with that. Once we've kept it till 2020, it's going to have been around for nearly a decade. And you're going to start to have that expectation. Now, the cost is going to go up as years go on. The magic of compounding, gains upon gains. Basically, with the triple lock, according to OBR figures, we're expected to send 6.8% of national income on state pensions by 2060. And without it, it would be 6%. So that's not a huge gap, but it's about an extra £15 billion a year. And there's also the suggestion that this means that basically we have to retire later, because there's a limited pot of money. Without the triple lock, a state pension age of 69 in 2050 could be 67 and a half.
Now, everyone I've spoken to about this on this show, including you, good self, is it going to stay? Is it going to go? Most say, no, it's going to go. Is this where money and politics collide, in that it will probably stay because it's politically sensitive, as opposed to whether it's a good idea or not? What do you reckon, Rachel?
Yes. I think that that's why Theresa May is delaying that decision. She hasn't committed either way yet. And if I were her, I'd be doing the same thing. If she can get away with it, if she knows that she's strong enough that she can ditch it and deal with the ramifications, older voters who tend to vote more being disgruntled, then she'll do it. If she thinks it's not worth the risk, then she won't bother. So yes, it's both. But I think that the problem is that no one can argue that it's a good idea for older people to have more money. I mean, that's great. A higher state pension, who wouldn't want that? But it has to be seen in the broader context of at what cost. If we're not committing to just spending more money, then it's going to come from somewhere else. And you could argue that there are other ways to support older people beyond just increasing the state pension, perhaps more money for the NHS, more money for social care. We've got a that's one of the biggest problems on the horizon, I think, is going to be social care for older people. It's just not funded at the moment. So maybe there's an argument for putting money that way. But as you say, there's limited space for more nuanced debate because it's so contentious, because triple lock. I mean, why did they give it such a catchy name?
Idiots.
It just sounds so good and it's understandable. And
a lock makes it sound permanent. Can't get rid of it.
Yeah. And desirable. I mean, why would you want to get rid of a triple lock?
Yeah, it's not just a single lock. A double lock is
a triple lock. So, yeah. Perhaps politics will win here.
A brief one we got from the think tank, the OECD, the other day about saying that perhaps we should just scrap the state pension for the rich anyway. What about that idea? The top 5 to 10%, Simon laughing along there.
To be fair, this chap at the OECD said, and I think in just a sort of a very mathematical sort of way, that with the increasing strain of the state pension, more and more older people, fewer younger people to support them, you've got, in theory, 3 options. 1, you cut the state pension for everyone. 2, you make everyone work for longer until they can access it. Or 3, you could scrap it for richer people. He did not talk about the practicalities of this, how you explain to people who have been paying in national insurance all their life that it was all for nothing, or explain to people, younger people, that they will continue to have to pay national insurance contributions and not benefit from it at all. I don't know that that would ever be possible. But I do understand the sentiment in terms of, you know, if you've got billionaires who are adding whatever it is, an extra £155 a week to their pot, when we've got a serious pensions crisis, I can see why he suggested that that could possibly be considered.
Simon, I haven't seen you go so red as when you're talking about Islington Council and your diesel tax and the like. What turned you so puce then?
I was just laughing at this suggestion of scrapping it for the rich. I mean, it's only the kind of thing that an economist could suggest. The outcry over that would be immense. Also, I think you need to trace a line back to this idea of the universal benefit. And the last time that there was a big debate over this was to do with child benefit, which, let's remember, was paid for many, many years to everyone and was, you know, predominantly meant to be for the children, not for the adults. But actually, it just went to being an extra bit of money, although some people did save it for their children. But that was taken away from people on higher incomes. There was an awful lot of debate about that. And the government just about got away with that one because of the time when it was done, just after the financial crisis. We were in deep, deep, deep trouble, austerity and so on. And I think people could recognise that this relatively small sum, although not inconsequential every month, if they were earning above a certain amount, you know, maybe they didn't need it. And if it meant it, other services, and it could be kept for other people, then that was fine. I think when it comes to the state pension, this would be a serious mistake. Now, there is an issue here, as Rachel just said. And one of the things, actually, with this triple lock scenario is someone wrote in a letter to the FT the other day saying, we talk about the triple lock costing us money, but what you have to remember is that an awful lot of that money that goes to pensioners, the bulk of it, basically just gets spent, goes straight back into the economy. So is it wasted money, or is it money that's actually stimulating the economy and being spent? However, there is a chunk of this money that is not being spent. There is a chunk of this money that is going to people who don't actually need it. There are a decent chunk of people who earn large sums of money who continue to work beyond state pension age, at which point their state pension starts to get paid. And now they can either take that money or they can defer it, and then their state pension starts to go up by even more. And for those people, or potentially for people who have very large final salary pensions or income from elsewhere, and, you know, there's not a huge number of these people, but there are plenty of these people out there, this money is just going into their bank accounts and building up. They're not actually spending this money. Essentially, it's going into their savings. So should we as a nation be doing that? But is the cost of saying, well, hang on a minute, look at these people over there who aren't spending their pension, they're just saving it, we're going to take it away from them, is the cost of that move so detrimental to the concept and the support from those people who earn more money to the tax system, who, let's face it, amongst all of this argument about whether people who are earning over £70,000, £80,000 a year should be paying more tax, you must remember that those people do actually already pay more tax. They pay about three times as much tax as the person paying the average wage. Is it worth annoying those people so much by taking it off them? And I think that was why my reaction to it was no, I don't think so. Anyway, on the pensions triple lock, we asked our readers about this.
Oh, yes, exactly. You've been running a poll on how age affects attitudes.
Yeah. So there's this suggestion that your view on the triple lock depends on your age. So if you're older, especially if you're a pensioner, then you're far more likely to support it because you're getting paid more money because of it. If you're younger, then you're considered to be far less likely to support it because you're paying for it at the same time as your pension age is receding into the distance and you're sitting there questioning whether you're ever going to get a state pension. So I asked the question and I divided the ages up and I went in the middle. I went, right, 50-year working career, 20 to 70, OK? So for someone starting work today, 20 to 70, let's go in the middle of that, 45. I mean, actually, it's probably a little bit young to test the attitudes, but I think straight down the middle. So if you're under 45, do you think we should keep the state pension triple lock? 59% said yes. If you are over 45, do you think that we should keep the state pension triple lock? 77% said yes. And that's out of about 2,000 people who voted in total. No, about 3,000 people who voted in total. So it does. I'm not surprised. But I am actually a little bit surprised at the number of people under 45 who said we should keep it. Although some of our readers have pointed out that we didn't put in place a stringent age verification test, so we could just have old people lying.
You could do, if they so really want to. Editor Simon Lambert, personal finance editor Rachel Ricard-Strauss.
Sharing ideas about money, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. Share Radio Morning.
Now, Rachel, you've been looking at the government's decision to scrap its manifesto pledge to freeze income tax, VAT and national insurance. Your reaction? Great. Why?
Because who wants a government that ties its hands at a time like this? If you think about how quickly things are changing. A government needs every tool at its disposal to be able to deal with it. It needs to be nimble. I think perhaps we get overexcited about what governments can actually do. One of its biggest jobs is spending money and bringing it in. National insurance, VAT and income tax count for something like 65% of all of the taxes that come in. By far the biggest chunk. I made up a little pie chart to show it. And I did the three big ones in pink so you can really see how much of that pie is taken up by those three. And then all of the other little slices are minuscule in comparison. So then to say to a chancellor, yeah, go ahead, do whatever you like, except you cannot touch these three things that make up most of the income, is too limiting, I think, at a time like this. When, if you think about how things have changed since 2015, when the pledge was introduced, that was only a couple of years ago, and how much they could change in the next 5 years, you don't want those kind of limitations. And I argued that one of the things that you see when you have those kind of restrictions is sneaky taxing. Which I think is worse. So governments sort of rummaging around, Osborne in particular, I think was really good at this, rummaging around, finding obscure taxes that no one's ever heard of and saying, oh, let's go after that one. So IPT, the most boring tax in the world, has gone up from 6-something percent to 12. Yeah. And just because he could get away with it, I think, because no one really knew what it was. But it's not like it's a tax on the rich or on profligacy. It's a tax on insurance, home insurance, car insurance, which you could argue that people are pretty prudent if they have it. And also it's fairly universal. So really, what is the difference to people's pockets between raising that tax and VAT, NI or income tax? The other thing that we see is government going after groups that don't exist yet. So you can
explain.
Yeah, no, that's probably not the best way of describing it. So things like probate fees and bereavement benefits have come under attack. Future bereaved people are not a campaign group because they don't exist yet.
Yeah.
You don't know that you're going to be hit by it until you are. And you may not even know that these benefits exist until you desperately need them. So the campaign against the increase in bereavement benefits has been led by people who have been bereaved already, who won't be affected by the changes, but see how valuable those benefits have been for them and don't want to see them taken away from people in future. But you do not have people who are going to be bereaved.
Yeah. So you think this could add to a bit more honesty?
Just a bit more transparency would be really cool.
All right, to our final issue, and this is the housing crisis. Jeremy Corbyn reckons the Conservatives will never fix it, but his party will if they win in June. Labour has released research claiming its councils have outbuilt Tory ones by an average of nearly 1,000 new properties since 2010. Development Director Nigel Guy says the problem needs to be made a priority.
Whatever government comes in, they need to really tackle these issues and not just talk about it during the electioneering. They need to really actually move forward and work with us to actually achieve what's needed for the nation.
Well, the Housing Minister insists the Conservatives recently set out a clear plan to build more affordable homes. Here's CEO of eMove, Russell Quirk.
This is rhetoric, frankly. And look, whether it's Labour or Conservative, for the last 30 years, all we've heard, particularly in election campaigns, is how they're going to be the party of housing. And neither of them have been. You know, we've seen a huge deficit in the difference between the housing that should be built and the housing that is built. It's pretty rich, I have to say, for Jeremy Corbyn to be saying this for two reasons. One is because John Healey, who's the shadow housing minister that I've watched with my sort of jaw open really this morning on BBC Breakfast, Sky News and so on, talking about, you know, criticising the Conservatives. He was the housing minister in 2008, 9 and 10 that presided over the lowest number of houses ever. The fact is, Labour have a terrible, terrible record on housebuilding, but then the Conservatives are not that much better either. Look, what we have seen, the National Housebuilding Council said that there's been a 17% increase in the same period. There is a direction of travel that's upwards. Have the Conservatives or Labour got a proper plan that is better than rhetoric to actually build the amount of homes we need? And I'm not just talking about 10,000 extra a year, I'm talking 100,000 extra a year. No, neither of them have.
Simon, briefly, can any party offer anything meaningful on housing?
Not really, because one of the real problems with housing in this country doesn't actually lie in the fact that we don't build enough of them, which we do not build enough of them, but it lies in the fact that money is super cheap and people borrow huge amounts of money, and that's what drives up house prices. And the problem that people have with houses doesn't tend to be that they can't find one. It tends to be that the ones that they can find are too expensive, and that is a direct reflection of cheap mortgages and cheap credit. However, I will pick a slight hole in something that Russell said there. He was talking about overall house building statistics, okay? Now, Corbyn's talking about council house building, okay? Local authority building. Local authority housing is a real problem. We don't build any of it anymore. We haven't built any for any years. The amount that is built is absolutely negligible. Jeremy Corbyn is probably correct in suggesting that Labour councils would build more of this than Tory councils. Now, there's probably also a correct assumptions to be made that some of those Labour councils, by the definition of where they tend to be, tend to be more inner city, urban, slightly more deprived areas, probably need more council housing than the Tory areas. Russell said something there, though, about overall house building, 2008, 2009, that it slumped and the Labour government were in charge at the time. They did, but that was off the back of the financial crisis and the massive property slump that was going on. There was an obvious fall in house building numbers because basically the builders were on the verge of going bust. All of our major builders, and actually many small-scale builders, did go bust. So you would expect there to be a slump in it, and I don't think that you can blame that on the government at that exact moment in time. You might be able to blame the boom from 2000 to 2007 on that Labour government, but probably not the lack of building afterwards. But maybe what we should have done is we should have gone, OK, we've got all these builders and they've got this massive amount of spare capacity because they're about to go bust and they want to build anything because they're freaking out. Why don't we throw a load of money at building some houses now because we don't build enough local authority homes? So what we could have done is bunged a couple of billion pounds in terms of stimulating the economy into the builders, got them to build a ton of local authority homes, and then we could have at least said, well, you know what, the one good thing that came out of the financial crisis was we built a load more local authority homes. However, the benefit of hindsight is a wonderful thing.
Coulda, shoulda, woulda, it would have been very hard to be Alistair Darling, was it, at the time, that would have had to make those decisions. I think that would have been a very hard call, not knowing what we know now. But that was then, this is now. That's the hole in Russell's argument. What about the holes in the politicians' argument? Can we get out of what is a housing crisis?
The problem is every time we try and build lots of homes, there's a big backlash against it from the people where the homes are going to be built, because basically people who live in areas where people keep trying to build homes don't trust the house builders or the local authorities to come through on their promises of the infrastructure that is needed and to build decent quality houses. So I think that what you need to do first is win over people's trust, and then maybe you can try and build those homes.
Oh, trust. All right, then we'll move on from that, because one thing that you would traditionally think would be a really serious problem for a government heading into a general election is weak economic growth. But this week, we heard it's now at its weakest since the EU referendum. Official stats show GDP's fallen from 0.7% to 0.3%. The Chancellor, Philip Hammond, he insists the UK economy is resilient, with growth forecast for 2% overall this year and record high employment.
Britain's economy is forecast to grow at 2% this year. Employment is at record highs and it's set to go higher still. The British economy is resilient.
The former Business Secretary Sir Vince Cable reckons there's tension between Philip Hammond and the Prime Minister.
If the economy is slowing down seriously, his government revenue position is going to weaken. He's going to have an armoury of policy, including raising taxes, and he needs to get that in the party manifesto. So there's a hell of a battle going on behind the scenes.
But is GDP the right way to measure the economy and economic growth? Now, Rachel's been hearing recently that it's a measure which can encourage governments to prioritise the wrong things at the expense of society. Now, that's according to Lorenzo Fiormonte, the Professor of Political Economy at the University of Pretoria and the latest guest on the Big Money Question Show.
A lot of the things that we wouldn't want to do in a good economy are counted positively towards GDP. So technically, the perfect GDP man would be obese, would be driving a car to work every time, get stuck in traffic, probably have a serious chronic disease, as I say in the book, on the verge of a divorce, because every divorce not only means new fees paid to lawyers, but also two houses to be bought and one house to sell. And all of these things add to GDP.
GDP man sounds delightful there. And before we get on to the problems around the measure, let's actually just talk about, I suppose, the measure itself and what it's showing recently, because this is at the moment how we're using it to measure the economy, and it's not looking so good. Time to panic, Simon?
Well, I think that things are, you know, this post-Brexit resilience that we had is running out of steam a little bit. But maybe that's not anything to do with Brexit. It's more to do with the consumer economy and basically people spending borrowed money. I think the problem is that because people's wages aren't really going up and essentially they're spending borrowed money. And now that we talked a few weeks ago about the banks cracking down on some of this consumer credit, that we are starting to see a little bit of a slowdown. So I'm not sure how we'll navigate our way out of that.
All right, then. Let's talk about GDP then, Rachel. What have you been hearing? Why is it so problematic?
It's one of those numbers, isn't it, that if you don't scrutinise it, it's easy to think it's just another, something like degrees Celsius.
What is it? Just explain.
But it measures our gross domestic product. So it measures all of the stuff that we are making and what it's worth. And it's measured, all the stuff that's measured in pounds and pence. It is that the argument of Lorenzo Fioramonte is that it's not objective, like degrees Celsius or, I don't know, the time. It's, first of all, only been around since the 1930s, and it measures some things that are really quite destructive and misses out other things that he thinks are of huge social benefit. So, for example, one example he gave was the countries that have experienced the highest GDP growth in recent times are South Sudan and Libya, and that's because they've both had civil wars recently. So destruction, really good for GDP, because you have to destroy stuff and then make it again. And when you make stuff, that costs money, so that all contributes to GDP. If you keep stuff the same, then that doesn't contribute to GDP at all. So he argues that there's an incentive then to destroy, and it also doesn't consider what is being destroyed to create new things. So if you are just sort of, you know, burning things, cutting down forests, to boost your GDP, that will look really good in the numbers, but they're things that you'll never be able to destroy again, and perhaps not in everyone's interests to do so.
So what's the answer? What do we need to do? We've spoken about economists earlier on in the show. Do we need to be a bit more human?
Human, yeah. Yeah, there's not an easy fix here. I suppose the first he would say would be to sort of talk about it, to recognise that GDP is flawed. The answer isn't necessarily just a new number, because things are pretty nuanced. It's so systemic that to change it would be pretty difficult, I think.
Isn't one of the problems as well that even when we use GDP, we don't use it very well, because we use this overall GDP number instead of using GDP per capita, so GDP per head? So basically you can... So say you've got a scenario where you've got 100 people in this little group, they've got their overall GDP. If you add another 50 people to that group, the GDP will go up, but it might not have gone up per head. They might not all be benefiting. That's an issue as well, isn't it?
That's an issue, and also the way that we measure it varies a lot from country to country. We've just recently introduced things like prostitution and illegal drugs selling have just been added to GDP. So that was a real boost for our economy on the surface. But you have to question whether sort of moving the numbers around really makes that much of a difference. Another interview I did last week was with Kate Raworth, which is also on the Big Money Questions. And she argues that the concept of growth itself is an issue. And actually, can you have unlimited growth? And at what point does that become problematic? And she argues that we need to move towards valuing thriving rather than growing, which would, of course, require a whole readjustment about how we, you know, our value system. But she argues that it's worth it and is necessary to be able to deal with the problems of the next century.
Well, it's not just Rachel that's been hogging all the interviewees. Simon, you also have. We're going to be talking about something a little bit different, because if the election here is all about Brexit, we have another election in full swing over the Channel as the centrist Emmanuel Macron, the far-right leader Marine Le Pen, go through to the second round of the French presidential elections. Could Frexit be on the cards? But why should we care about what's going on in France? Simon, you say it could all prove rather important. You've been speaking to Charles Stanley's chief global strategist, John Redwood.
I think the markets are very relieved, because the markets do not wish to have a Le Pen or Melenchon victory, because either of those candidates wanted to upend the euro and fundamentally change France's relationship with the EU, which would have all sorts of knock-on effects to the single currency and to assets in the euro area. And it looks as if Melenchon has gone, obviously, because he was knocked out on the first round, and it looks as if there will be a fairly easy victory for Monsieur Macron against Madame Le Pen in 2 weeks' time when we come to the second round. That's the result the markets want. It's not without its hazards, because, of course, the markets will start saying to themselves, but how can Monsieur Macron be the president of France and have executive results? Because, of course, he doesn't have a party, and he may not have a lot of MPs in their parliament willing to do his bidding. So we were then going to have to live through the worry about the French Assembly elections in June, which will determine how much support Macron has for his programme. But overall, it's good news for European assets.
So perhaps an easy win for Monsieur Macron. Yes, and we're part of the EU still, and Hillary Clinton is the that's not the case, is it? So Simon, you've got 2 minutes to persuade us why should we care what's happening in France, apart from the fact we love the French.
Apart from the fact that we love the French, yeah, and we care about the future of the world.
We.
If you spend any time in France over the past, you know, decade or 15 years, and you go outside of the major cities, you will have noticed an substantially growing support for the Front National, the National Front, which used to be run by Marine Le Pen's dad. He was drummed out of the party, however, and she has taken it much more mainstream. And it is a fully fledged mainstream French political party. But it is, I think, what can fairly be described as a far-right party. They have some pretty strong views on things like immigration and kicking immigrants out. And also, they want to have their own EU referendum, should they be part of the EU. And Marine Le Pen is not a fan of the EU, and she is not a fan of the euro. And there are a lot of disenfranchised people in France. And if you look at this argument that there are people who feel that the world of globalisation and the world of free trade has possibly benefited some parts of society, i.e. the rich, and not others, i.e. the poorer people, and who feel like they've been left behind by this whole thing. And that these are the this is one of the arguments as to why some people voted for Brexit, why some people voted for Donald Trump, and why some people are voting for Marine Le Pen. Because what is being promised to them is, we are going to make your life better again. And the way we are going to make your life better again is, we're going to crack down on this whole globalisation idea. We're going to crack down on this whole idea of free trade. We're going to bring in protectionism and things like that. And I think of all of those things, Marine Le Pen is probably one of the most worrying, actually, for some of the things that lie on the fringes of what her party say they will do. And if France were to basically enact leaving the euro, or enact leaving the euros, the European Union, a Frexit, then that would be absolutely disastrous for Europe. Basically, Europe can deal with Britain leaving. We're one member who didn't want to join the euro. All we do is basically hang around moaning about stuff and that we don't like it, and can we get out of it? We're basically like the kid at school who has a permanent letter off games. Doesn't want to play, doesn't want to be a team player. France, however, is a central part of that team and has been ever since, you know, the EU was invented. And for France to leave, it would basically involve a huge breakup. If the euro goes down, it would probably involve some kind of financial crisis. It would be bad news. And that bad news is not going to not affect us sitting over here on the other side of the channel, just because we might happen to have exited the EU by that point. But also, I think one of the issues is, and not to make this political really, but Macron has campaigned on a message of positivity and a message of hope and a message of, we can try and make things better. We are lucky. We have lots of things in this world. We are much luckier than other people, and we can try to make things better. Yes, things are not perfect, but we will try to make things better. And by standing together, we will be stronger. Marine Le Pen has campaigned very much on the stuff is rubbish. You need to, you know, complain about it and fight back about it and kick back. And in many of those northern French towns, or some of the, you know, southern French towns, those places outside of the major cities, life is pretty rubbish, actually. Mm. And they don't have the jobs. They don't have the opportunities. They feel that the world has passed them by. They feel that actually protectionism would do them much more of a favour than free trade. But I think that is that's a message of negativity, and at the moment the message of positivity looks like it's going to win, but only because everybody's going to gang up and tell all of the other candidates, and it was evenly split this first round, are basically ganging up and telling all of their supporters to vote for Macron. And that is no guarantee that he's going to win, and I actually think that Marine Le Pen will probably do better than the polls suggest.
Simon, I think this show's been a little bit lightweight. You know, I don't think we've really delved into the big political, economic matters. But don't worry, we can salvage it in this final episode. Could we see the French franc return? Maybe. Let's focus, though, on that pound in our pocket, the English pound. It's not all coins this week, or the British pound, should I say. But the paper variety, specifically the fiver. Now, the new plastic version was introduced back in September. We had a swathe of stories about how some are selling for thousands of pounds. But soon the old paper version could be worth a big fat zilch. You have just over a week to spend it before it is no longer accepted on the high street. Rachel, what are the rules?
They're all worth millions of pounds now. And when it comes to the deadline, you all have to burn them in a big bonfire. No, that's not true.
That's a pop group did that, didn't they?
The KLF.
Yeah, KLF. There you go, Simon.
You can still fob them off on the Bank of England any time you like, and they will give you in return... £5.
Whoa, that's nuts.
They'll give you £5.
Crazy. What if you find it in sort of like 10 years' time? Will it still be able to convert it?
£5.
Oh, they'll still give you £5?
I think so, yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't know whether it will be worth quite...
You'll have lost a bit of money on...
buy what...
No, yeah, that's true.
But, yeah, I don't think that there's a limit on the Bank of England. I haven't noticed this. I would expect, with this deadline looming, some kind of hot potato situation where everyone's trying to sneak them into their change and not accept them back and all that kind of stuff. I totally haven't seen that happen. I don't know if it gets closer to the time, or if it's just something that I personally have not experienced. But I wonder whether a lack of awareness of this strict deadline will mean that people might still be accepting the odd paper note after that date.
Saying that, I think they've been really efficient, haven't they? First of all, you couldn't get your hands on one, and now I can't get my hands on a paper one. I've not seen one in months. Has anyone else?
I haven't seen a paper one in absolutely ages. I've got a plastic one in my hand now. I was just weighing it up as to whether I like this more or whether I like this less, how bothered I am. And I do think they are a little bit plasticky and they are a little bit toy money.
That's the point, yeah.
But I have very much got used to them now. And I wonder whether if I suddenly started getting the old one back, whether I would think, actually, I preferred the new one. I mean, this one, unfortunately, is only worth £5 because the code in it is AL24.
Oh, don't start that.
And so unless you live in that postcode. I tell you the one thing that is conspicuous by its absence at the moment is the new pound coin. Where are all of they?
I've got them all.
Have you?
Yeah.
Have you had any, Rachel?
I've got loads of them.
I've had three at once.
Yeah. Last Friday, my mum had one. She got it out to show us because all of us in the room said we hadn't seen one yet.
Saying that, though, how much do you use cash nowadays? Because I rarely do, right?
I've got a fiver in my pocket.
There you go. Go and spend it. Let's see. I'll have a pint of editor Simon Lambert, personal finance editor Rachel Regan-Strauss.